are marching at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Hear the people.
As we come marching.
That's what we're asking.
So many
hear the people. People marching all over the world now, occupying. And here at Valley Free Radio, we're asking you to occupy your mind and occupy the airwaves. This is the Bread and Roses show, normally on a Friday afternoon, and rebroadcast on Monday at 11. But for technical reasons that will remain a mystery, my name is Elliot Terry, and I am here live doing a live version of Monday rebroadcast of the Bread and Roses show. Actually, I'm here live because of technical difficulties. I lost the interview, or part of the interview that I had recorded last Friday, and I'm going to bring that to you today, an interview with union organizer Rose Bookbinder, who is working closely with the Occupy movement down in Wall Street. But we'll get to that in a little bit after we talk about some other things. This is, I believe, day 50-something of the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street, with movements all around the world doing their thing and making some changes. For instance, in London, the Occupy movement there, inadvertently, just because they decided to sit in and were challenged by the church, inadvertently, they created a discussion, a national discussion, leading to resignations of church officials and the discussion over the morality of executive pay, of greed, of the wars, and all of the associated evils that come with greed and corporate malfeasance. So that's something that happened in London, and you know, of course we know the violence that has occurred in the mostly we would assume from provocateurs that have infiltrated or were sent in to cause violence, just as they did in Tahrir Square on some level. And now we have the word Tahrir being applied to the ship that was seized on its way to Gaza. Here at the Bread and Roses show, we usually have several hosts and bringing you different topics every week. One of our hosts, Pocky Whalen, would normally be have done a show the first week in the month, but Pocky is a dedicated activist for peace and justice. And that dedication takes her to different parts of the world, as it is, as well as different parts of the country, to engage in acts of civil disobedience and nonviolence. As such, Pocky is now in Egypt and had planned to be part of the two-boat flotilla that, again, was trying to break the blockade that Israel has placed around Palestine and Gaza, rather. And she is okay. She did not manage to get onto the boats, even though that was the plan. Apparently, the Turkish government, the country from which the one of the boats sailed, the boat Tahrir, I believe, sailed from Turkey. And the Turkish government, in negotiation with from the organization to free Gaza from the blockade, refused to let would only allow a certain number of people on the boat, and Paki did not make the cut, so she did not go on the boat to Gaza. Instead, she and some others decided to try to get into Gaza through Egypt, and wound up in Cairo. And I'm not exactly sure at this point whether she was successful or whether she's standing outside the checkpoint at the border. But I do have a letter that was written, an email that Paki sent, and I'm going to read that to everyone. It's some reflections upon actually her arrival and anticipation of getting on the boat to Gaza, and then I believe finding out that she was not able to get on, but still the exhilaration of knowing that her brothers and sisters in the cause were getting on there. So I will read that. This is from Paki Whelan, sent several days ago. Dear friends, I am writing this from Cairo, where we wait for news of our friends on the Tahrir. I write with such mixed feelings. Joy that our justice seekers are exposing the humanitarian crimes of the U.S.-backed Israeli government by sailing to Gaza. Happiness that two boats, one with Irish and one with international passengers, are challenging the blockade. The whole world is watching. The negotiations our organizers engaged in with the Turkish authorities disallowed more of us participating on the boats. This was difficult for the organizers and very difficult for those of us who made sacrifices to be in Turkey to sail to Gaza. Discussions of the noted disappointments and difficulties could be turned into what I call weapons of mass distraction, taking the focus off why we sail, and that would be contrary to our purpose. I prefer to invite you to join me in talking about the international support of the people of Gaza, the cry for justice of the Palestinian people, and our response, support, for the boats that sailed. Some of us came to Cairo with hopes of getting into Gaza through the Rafah Gate. This is still a possibility. Meanwhile, as I reflect on our occupations at home while breathing Egyptian air, I am so aware that we are engaged in a movement of magnitude unseen ever before. It is truly a worldwide response, sometimes hard to recognize at the same struggle, but I believe, and we have evidence, that it is. We must not lose patience, but stay open to all the voices, all the possibilities. We are not, even at home, articulating one message of demand, but the clarity is coming. The dreamers of the deferred dreams and the disillusioned are coming together. The inevitable friction causes both heat and light. May we do all we can to keep our focus on the light. Patience is not the dominant virtue of our U.S. culture. May we appreciate that our strength in occupations at home is informed by many sources. May we have humility as we stand, sit, march, and sail with our sisters and brothers around the world who have much to show us. After 9/11, I reflected that America had entered the world community, a community which experiences wanton violence over which ordinary people exercise no control. In February 2003, when people around the world marched for peace, the New York Times observed that there are now two superpowers, the U.S. and the people of the world. Let us take this observation to heart. Let us be the superpower for change, for justice. we know that the reigning injustice of the 1% or even 9% can be overcome by the commitment and creativity of us, the 90 to 99%. I listened to our friend Mazin, who in response to my question about supporting the Palestinian struggle for freedom, reminds me that it is our shared struggle. Our shared struggle, this movement requires both breadth and depth. Will it, can we, invite through many eyes and perspectives a clear vision of the specifics, grievances, and crimes? We invite all to share visions of living today, the world we dream of tomorrow. These are challenges I see as we move forward. Patience and openness to hear the voices that have been silenced. I was encouraged by the following exchange on my visit to Occupy Wall Street a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned to a young woman that I am a raging granny. Her response was, "It is good to have old people with us. We need your wisdom." My response to her was, "We need your ideas and your energy." All this to share that we can find avenues to appreciate what each of us brings to this worldwide struggle for justice. I finally want to acknowledge that we do not know the outcomes, and we can expect that the powerful will not roll over welcoming us to co-create a more just world. For us, trust building through staying in the conversation may be one of our challenges, but it will lead to good outcomes. Those are my thoughts for now. I send this with the deepest thanks for you, my friends, comrades, sisters, and brothers with whom we share this life in these times for which all our lives have prepared us. Paki. That was sent several days ago from Cairo, Egypt, by our co-host here on Bread and Roses, Paki Whelan. And I just thought I needed to share that with everyone. Now, those that did get on the boat did not reach Gaza, as we all know. And I received an update email on November 6th of the Freedom Waves to Gaza boats. And I will read that as well. The takeover of the Tahrir and the Sawas was violent and dangerous. Despite very clear protests from the occupants of the two boats that they did not want to be taken to Israel, they were forcibly removed from the boats in a violent manner. The whole takeover took about 3 hours. Many of those on Canadian boat were beaten. It began with Israeli forces hosing down the boats with high-pressure hoses and pointing guns at the passengers through windows. Fintan Lane on the Suarez was hosed down by the stairs of the boat. Windows were smashed and the bridge of that boat nearly caught fire. The boats were corralled to such an extent that the two boats, the Suarez and the Tahrir, collided with each other and were damaged, with most of the damage happening to the MV Suarez. The boats nearly sank. The method used in the takeover was very dangerous. The Israeli forces initially wanted to leave the boats at sea, but the abductees demanded that they not be left to float unmanned at sea, for they would be lost and possibly sunk. David Heap, a Canadian delegate, was tasered and beaten. All belongings of the passengers were taken off them and crew, and they still do not know if and what they will get back. Six prisoners were released, both the Greek captains, two of the journalists, and two delegates. The passengers remained in Givon Detention Center, and many, including Kit Kittredge of the U.S., have not been able to make phone calls. Those remaining are being asked to sign deportation papers which state that they came into Israel illegally and that they will not attempt another effort to break the Gaza blockade. If they sign, they will not be allowed into Palestine through Israel for 10 years. Obviously, their goal was to go to Gaza, not Israel, and a signature could validate Israel's right to blockade Gaza. So they refused to sign. This will mean longer detention. Their continued detention is designed to force them to agree to abandon their legal rights and have nothing to do with the security of Israeli citizens. Just like the blockade of Gaza's civilians is clearly punitive and has nothing to do with the security of Israeli civilians. Our State Department has not been an advocate for its citizens. They would rather join Israel in stating that we are terrorists. President Obama on Thursday said the passengers on these boats are defying Israeli and American law. He must have been confused. It's the other way around. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland said the U.S. was renewing its call to Americans not to involve themselves in this activity and warned of possible consequences. The organizers are calling on everyone to get on the phone today and call the U.S. Emergency Consular Services at 202-647-4000. It's U.S. Emergency Consular Services, 202-647-4000. 202-647-4000. And the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv. I won't give you that number. Tell them you want to, if you like, tell them to insist that Israel free the prisoners immediately and end the siege of Gaza. And that's an update from those that are organizing the blockade, Jane Hirschman and Felice Gilman. Now, I'd like to read one more thing. A letter from the man David Heap, who was among those seized on the Tahrir boat to Gaza and imprisoned by the Israelis. David says, "I write to you from cell 9 of the apartheid state of Israel. Dear sisters and brothers, friends and loved ones, I write to you from cell 9, block 59, Givon prison near, I think it should be Ramallah, in occupied Palestine. Although I was tasered during the assault on the Tahrir and bruised during forcible removal dockside, I am limping slightly as a result, I am basically okay. We, Ehab, Michael, Karen from Tahrir, as well as Karen, Kit from the U.S. and Jihan, who we saw briefly this morning, we are most concerned about our Tahrir shipmate, Palestinian Majid Kayal from Haifa. Last seen by us at Ashdod being photographed and put in a police car. Although Michael and I, among others, were transported in handcuffs and leg shackles, let me stress that we were neither criminals nor illegal immigrants, but rather political prisoners of the apartheid state of Israel. Four from the Tahrir are imprisoned with 12 Irish comrades from the Swaris, who have more experience with such issues. The four of us, Ehab and I, Michael and Hassan, have joined with the Irish and their political prisoners committee in order to press our collective demands. The demands are association in the block, that is, open cells. Also, adequate writing and reading materials. And free communication with the outside world, that is, regular phone calls. And information about shipmate women held at the same prison. We add one Tahrir-specific demand that Israeli state recognize the professional status of Democracy Now! Journalist Jihan Hafiz, in accordance with her credentials from the U.S. government. All political incarceration is unjust, but let me stress that in duration and conditions, our situation pales in comparison to the plight of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners and to the open-air prison of Gaza. If you have energy to devote to solidarity actions in the coming days, please concentrate on them. We must get Tahrir back and hope freedom waves continue." And he signs that and uses, I believe, I'm not sure if this is Native American, but it sounds like Ashnabi Debuun Vitons Human. Stay human in love and struggle, David. Now, there's a note, Majid Kalyal was released, but it appears David and the other political prisoners weren't told where he was taken. Okay, this is The Bread and Roses Show. My name is Elliot Terry. I just got finished reading some updates from the prison where those that were taken off the Tahrir and the Suarez boats to Gaza are staying, and an update on the situation. And before that, a letter of reflections from Paki Whelan, who was not able to get on the boat, prevented. Okay, now let's just take a little break here and listen, I hope, to some poetry.
I will not dance to your war drum. I will not lend my soul nor my bones to your war drum. I will not dance to your beating. I know that beat. It is lifeless. I know intimately that skin you are hitting, it was alive once, hunted, stolen, stretched. I will not dance to your drummed up war. I will not pop, spin, break for you. I will not hate for you or even hate you. I will not kill for you. Especially, I will not die for you. I will not mourn the dead with murder nor suicide. I will not side with you or dance to bombs because everyone is dancing. Everyone can be wrong. Life is a right, not collateral or casual. I will not forget where I come from. I will craft my own drum. Gather my beloved near, and our chanting will be dancing. Our humming will be drumming. I will not be played. I will not lend my name nor my rhythm to your beat. I will dance and resist and dance and persist and dance. This heartbeat is louder than death. Your war drum ain't louder than this breath.
Come all of you good workers, this news to you I'll tell. The rights we take for granted now, we have no right to sell. Does anyone remember the days with bold John L? It's thanks to him no child of mine will know the breaker's hell. Tell me, which side are you on?
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 Which side are you on? From the world of suits and ties. They preach cooperation. Don't listen to their lies. Your parents bled and starved to claim your right to organize. Which side are you on?
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 Which side are you on? Let's remember where we come from, and our union cannot fail. Remember who we are, my friends, and I know we will prevail. The fire has been rekindled, and Pittston tells the tale. Our lives are ours and ours alone, and the future's not for sale. Tell me, which side are you on?
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 Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on? I hope you're on the side of independent media in the Pioneer Valley. WXOJ LP 103.3 on your FM dial or valleyfreeradio.org on the internet. This is the Bread and Roses Show. We do hope you support independent media, independent of the corporate state, independent of corporate control, or which is exercised through advertiser control, in a sense. And that includes National Public Radio, I'll say right now. You know, the arrest the firing of a contributor to National Public Radio simply because she was at a support rally for the Occupy movement, or for the down in Washington at the calling for against the corporate personhood, talked out against corporate personhood, and she was sacked, arranged by National Public Radio because they need corporate support, and they toe the line. But here at Valley Free Radio, we draw a different line in the sand. So I hope you do support us. We had heard there Ann Feeney from her album Union Made, Which Side Are You On? And also before that, Sharir Hamad, who is a Palestinian-American poet and filmmaker. So everything is tied together. Everything, it's all one struggle, as Pocky Whalen was saying. And part of that struggle is happening down in Wall Street. And the unions have been a great aid to the Occupy Wall Street movement. So without further ado, I'm going to move to an interview that was recorded on Friday with UAW, that's United Auto Workers Union Organizer, Rose Bookbinder, who is on the outreach committee that is working directly with the Occupy Wall Street movement, organizers or non-organizers, however they like to be seen. So let's just go right now, hopefully it will work, to this interview with Rose Bookbinder of the UAW. Rose Bookbinder is a union organizer with the UAW in New York City and Massachusetts. Her fight for economic justice began at the State University of New York Purchase campus, where she led student sit-ins in support of striking food service workers and incurred disciplinary actions by the SUNY administration. Her efforts did not go unnoticed, as Ms. Bookbinder was drafted by AFSCME as an organizer while on academic suspension. She began working with the United Auto Workers in 2008 and was soon transferred to New York City to organize grad student workers at NYU. When Occupy Wall Street began, the UAW offered immediate support, and for weeks, Rose Bookbinder has been working side by side with the Occupy Wall Street General Assembly and was instrumental in turning out union members at 6 a.m. on October 14th to stand in opposition to the city's planned eviction of the protest encampment at Zuccotti Park. Rose Bookbinder, welcome to the Bread and Roses Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to join you on the show.
Yeah, you're busy woman, and I know that you're taking a train right now to back to Western Mass. So I hope we get the sound quality that we need.
You might hear the occasional train bell, but we can keep moving forward.
You know, Rose, I should say welcome back to the Bread and Roses Show. One thing I did not mention in that introduction is that you are from Northampton, the working in New York, and are a former host and contributor to the Bread and Roses Show.
This is true. Yeah, it's great to be back.
Yeah. So we talked about your work with the UAW. First, let me ask you about that. You're organizing grad students, which is, I guess, right now it's a fairly controversial issue. Where did that begin? How did that get started for the UAW particularly?
Sure. Well, the UAW currently represents over 60,000 academic workers throughout the country, which not everybody is aware of because obviously our name wouldn't lend to that thought, seeing as we're the United Auto Workers, but some people like to say the Union of All Workers, because we actually represent a variety of different types of workers. The UAW just locally represents grad students at the University of Massachusetts Amherst campus, as well as Boston and Lowell. So we've been, you know, this has been in our history for many years, and we began a fight at NYU to organize the grad students there over 10 years ago. Currently, private sector grad students under the federal law of the National Labor Relations Act do not have the right to collectively bargain. But previously, they were awarded that right, and NYU grad students had the first and only contract, recognized union contract in the country for 3 years. But during the Bush era labor board, there was a appeal to that decision brought on by the Brown University, in which Brown University, in fact, won, and they stripped private sector grad students the right to bargain, stating that grad student workers who are teaching assistants and research assistants do not have an economic relationship with the university, and that their work is inherently tied in with their student status. But we have continued to mobilize and organize at NYU, and when the Obama administration put their appointees in that, you know, are more worker-friendly board agents, we ramped up the campaign. The grad students ramped up their campaign and mobilized and signed people up and submitted for recognition for a union election, and we held hearings with the regional labor board to demonstrate that grad students are in fact workers and do have an economic relationship. So currently we're waiting for that Brown decision to be overturned, and we're anxiously hoping that that will happen this semester so that we are able to have a union election and that the grad students have an opportunity to vote in that election and have their rights reinstated as employees of the University of NYU. And this would affect, you know, private sector grad students throughout the country if this was to happen. So we're continuing to mobilize, and Occupy Wall Street has really pushed our mobilizing even to another level and brought in a lot of grad students who weren't normally involved in organizing around a union have now sort of been pushed into that more and excited by the opportunities of being involved with a local campaign to get union recognition for grad students and then also make those connections to a general change in the system for the country.
How interesting that that would occur through the Occupy movement, because it's a youth movement and of radical young people. That's interesting. But I want to get to the Occupy in a bit. What I'd like to do is explore the legal and philosophical issues that are in conflict. It seems as though they made a good argument, Brown University, because they did get that decision overturned. And the argument is that it's part of the student status to be teaching. Now, what's your counter argument?
Well, I think that that's just completely bogus. You know, we've have research assistants and TAs that really do bulk of a lot of the work that is needed at a university. They teach the undergrad classes, they do the grading, they do the discussion classes, and really make the component of what is a university, the undergrad, you know, experience, a bachelor's degree, work. If it wasn't for them, you know, the university would not be generating the money that they do for the tuition. In addition, research assistants that are in labs for, you know, upwards of 80 hours a week, I mean, they're just in there doing the research that brings the prestige to the university, as well as millions and millions of dollars of grants and money that really keep a university going.
Okay.
So the line between grad students being workers and the economic relationship that they do, in fact, have with the university is just so apparently obvious to me and to many within the labor movement and just the general public.
Well, it being obvious might not be the point. Let me play devil's advocate here and parse this out. What if the argument that the justices on the court are putting forth in agreement with Brown is that exploitation is, in fact, part of your education. What if that's their argument?
Well, actually, I did leave out a portion of the history of what's happened recently, but we had these 6 months around of hearings at the regional board in New York, and we were actually issued a decision from the regional board. It was his opinion that there was a very clear economic relationship between grad students and the university, that in fact, regardless of funding source, whether it was internal or external funding that grad students received and whether they were research assistants or TAs, that there was an economic relationship. But at the regional level in New York, he did not feel comfortable overturning the Brown decision and in fact then sort of pushed that back to the Washington board to actually make the overturning of Brown. But it was very clear to me that the reason why that decision was had ever been decided in the way that it did is that there was corruption at the board. There was, you know, there were board agents who were employers, and their best interest was to side with the university rather than really hearing out the merits of the case.
And what board are we talking about?
The Bush-era board that in 2005 overturned Brown.
Oh, you're talking about a board. I thought we were talking about appeals courts.
No, this is the National Labor Relations Board.
Oh, okay, so you're dealing with the National Labor Relations Board, which isn't a court of law. Oh, I see.
Right.
I was trying to explore a legal...
Yeah.
I thought this was a legal argument. All right, well, let me pick at it some more, though. You're talking about an economic relationship, and is that key to the legal argument somehow, that there is an economic relationship?
Yeah, because, in fact, I mean, RAs and TAs are paid by the university for the work that they do.
But why is that a bearing on the decision in terms of exploitation? What if they just want to exploit you?
Well, that's what defines, you know, work exchange of and money. I mean, the National Labor Relations Act is inherently connected to the Commerce Clause within, you know, that's what gives workers the right to organize, is their relationship to the employer in terms of money.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for. That's it.
Yeah.
Bingo. There should be a gong. Boom. Okay, so, the coincidence of Occupy Wall Street bringing you more grad students and a connection through the activities there. First of all, I want to ask you if the UAW came out officially in support of the Occupy movement.
Yes. We have, at the international level, the president of the UAW, along with, you know, the unions as a whole, has endorsed the Occupy Wall Street movement and is devoting resources, you know, whether people, money, supplies, to the Occupy movement, and feels that it's very important as a union and as our members to get involved in this moment and, you know, be a part of it and help to shape it, but also just, you know, work off of the light that has been and the spark that's happened, because, you know, the unions have been struggling to spark something like this for, you know, over 40 years now, and finally a group has been able to do that, and it's important for us to get involved in it. So previous to the October 5th rally, which was a labor and community rally that happened in New York City, which was one of the largest rallies that happened in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street, we put out an endorsement of that rally, but also of the movement in general. And, you know, a lot of unions have now done that as well. And this was a way to really try to provide just to push the movement forward a little bit, because the media has been trying to minimalize the movement by claiming it's just a bunch of young kids and hippies who have no idea what's going on. But really, when you go down there and you participate in the actions, it's a hugely diverse group, from young to old, from, you know, black to white to immigrant, and all of the above, many different people.
This is, of course, the key to the success, I believe. That is, union support for the Occupy movement has been said time and time again, not only on this show, but throughout the media and observers. Not here just in the United States, but the Egyptian model was in Tahrir Square, was the union support that came out, really put them into a powerful position. And so it was here in New York. And it was not always so. There's something different now in the air. The unions were very much part of the United for Peace and Justice and the anti-war movement, the labor organized against war group, and others. And now with the Occupy movement, it makes it historic. It makes it, you can feel the energy in the air as it's palpable. Particularly in the wake of what happened in Wisconsin, and in the face of the union busting, final union busting efforts by the right wing, well, the 1% that Occupy is fighting against. So I'm really happy to see the UIW in there, and you. So tell us exactly what you're doing down there for the Occupy.
Sure. Well, yes, the UAW and unions all across the city have really mobilized and been participating in everyday actions and organizing. The Occupy Wall Street movement has really sort of morphed into something different. I guess I'll just take you through, like, the last few weeks.
Oh, yeah, please.
A lot of the organizing and discussion and actions were really coming out of Zuccotti Park, or as it's really called now amongst the community, like Liberty Plaza. That was like the hub of where people really went. And there was a general assembly that happened every day at 7 p.m. And there were meetings that were happening right there in the park or very close by in surrounding areas. But as things have gotten more cold and the need has arisen for there to be tents actually set up in the park, the space is not really conducive to a lot of discussion and conversation and organizing, because it's just really packed full of folks that have committed themselves to occupying that space. There's around 50 or so working groups that have come out of the General Assemblies of Occupy Wall Street, and one of those is the Labor Outreach Committee, and that group has a lot of both rank and file members and representatives from staff that actually attend the meeting as a representative from the unions. And from there, you know, a lot of organizing happens. And those meetings happen in union halls or union meeting rooms all over the city. So there's organizing that's happening all over the place, not just out of the park anymore. So we've been involved in those, the Labor Outreach Committee, since it started. That meeting has, you know, usually around over 100 people in attendance from, you know, dozens of different unions. And what happens in those meetings is just updates on what unions are doing to support Occupy Wall Street. There's a subgroup of that that's just involved in doing outreach to unions to one, get them to endorse and commit resources to the movement, both people and material goods. And then there's just action-oriented component of the Labor Outreach Committee where, you know, unions are now coming to this Labor Outreach Committee meeting and asking for endorsement on particular actions. For example, one unifying campaign that's really brought together labor and Occupy Wall Street is Sotheby's, which is an auction house that brings in I believe it's billions of dollars. It could be millions, but I think it's actually billions of dollars from artwork that they auction off. It's a very famous auction house in New York City. And these are, you know, members of the 1% that are buying these pieces of artwork at, you know, huge amounts of money. And the workers, who are Teamster members, have been locked out now for almost 3 months over contract negotiations. And they have, you know, scab laborers working in the auction house. And so Occupy Wall Street, along with the Labor Outreach Committee, have been mobilizing for actions actually during the auctions that they have. They go in and they disrupt the auctions and participate in really bringing attention to the issues that workers are facing generally, but also that these individual locked-out Teamster workers are facing, because the Teamsters that are locked out can't actually participate in these actions because of the situation that they're in. They're, you know, picketing and doing that, but they're not actually participating in the direct action that's happening. And that's where the Labor Outreach Committee and the Occupy Wall Street movement as a whole has been really aiding in this and showing, bringing to light what the 1% are doing against the 99%.
So you're part of the Labor Outreach Committee?
Yes.
And one of the things that is going on in the media everywhere, it seems, at least when I listen, is the characterizations of the Occupy movement. And not much link is made between the Occupy movement and the unions. There's always the link that's made between those that are the slackers or the homeless that are staying there. But there also is the tone of dismissiveness. This is a hard, I guess, question and thing to put your finger on, but what's your sense of being there all this time about the vibrancy and the for lack of a better term, the legs, the growth potential of the Occupy movement?
Well, I think it's really just begun. It's just the very beginning, and there's, you know, new community groups, new labor unions, new activists that are brought in all the time to these meetings. There's, as I said, you know, over 50 working groups. For example, there's People of Color Working Group. There's an outreach group that goes into the boroughs and does education and brings people into the different occupations that are happening in the boroughs. There's just too many to even name. I would recommend people go on to the New York City General Assembly webpage. You can access it from the OccupyWallStreet.org webpage and just see how many groups are really mobilizing and working towards different issues. You know, there's the environmental working group, there's the immigrant rights working group, and everybody's staying, communicating amongst those groups through a spokes council that has formed. Now, there are, of course, people down there that, you know, are just coming down to observe, but that's bringing light to the issues. There's signs, there's people having conversations. There's a real openness when you go down to Zuccotti Park. People engage you and talk to you, ask you why you're there, and talk about the issues. And I think it's wonderful that there are homeless people going down there. I mean, there's the Occupy Wall Street has nearly $500,000 that they've received in donations, and they're being able to provide food to homeless people, and I think that's wonderful. I think that that's a kind of example of what a community should look like, and I think that's what Zuccotti Park is doing and what Liberty Plaza is doing. It's providing an example of what society can look like. While there might not be demands yet, the example of how we should be living and how we should be supporting each other, providing basic needs to each other is what's coming out and shining through Park to say that another world is possible, and we can do that.
Let me just say, this is the Bread and Roses Show on WXOJ 103.3 LP in Northampton, streaming live at valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Elliot Terry. I'm talking with Rose Bookbinder of the United Auto Workers Union. She's an organizer now working down in New York City with organizing grad students and working with the General Assembly and as an outreach coordinator with the union and the Occupy Wall Street movement. So keeping on that theme of where the movement is going and what you've seen in terms of the connections between the union and the Occupy, another criticism that had been made for a while was that there is no consistent message. What has been the impact of the union meetings and the union issues and other groups on defining or refining message?
Well, I actually think that there is a message. The message is, you know, we need a change in this system. Just we're the wealthiest nation in the world, yet we have people losing their homes and starving and homeless. I think that that's the message. I think what people are agreeing upon, though, is that they don't want to define demands or goals. And I think that's what's actually so beautiful about the movement right now, is that it's allowed for so many people that feel like the system isn't working for them to come in. And if it had had predefined demands or goals, that wouldn't have allowed for this movement to grow in the way that it has. And so it's just at the beginning, it's just at the infancy, and we need to be talking and working together and figuring out what some of those demands are. But it's hard to put that in a media soundbite. I have to say that, you know, we want huge change in the way that our system and our country is moving. You can't put that into a simple list of, you know, demands. And I don't think it's the time or place to do that yet, because we need to continue to grow the movement and build those connections and figure those things out together. Because if it had been defined, I really don't think it would have gotten to the place that it has today.
So what is the immediate future in terms of the weather and staying in Liberty Plaza?
Well, right now, I can tell you what we're building towards is another National Day of Action on November 17th. This is being spearheaded by a group of labor unions and community groups, United New York, the Working Families Party, and Strong Economy for All. This day is about, you know, the title is We Are the 99% National Day of Action, Jobs Not Cuts, and Tax the 1%. And the UAW and various unions are endorsing this action. And so, you know, I think it's just continuing to build for these large actions and demonstrate the power that this movement has, and bringing in, you know, just creating more coalitions, which is, I think, what's really been lacking over the last few years. People have been so focused on their own individual issues that we haven't been building the coalitions that we need to really tackle the problem. In terms of preparation, I mean, they've created structures within the Zuccotti Park with tents and generators and things like that. But again, as I said, you know, I think the movement has really grown out of the park itself. A lot of the organizing and day-to-day planning happens inside buildings. Unions have all generously given their spaces for meetings, and there's a group of, I think, over 100 space-based spaces that have offered, you know, space for showers and also for sleeping if it gets cold, and organizing facilities if need be in these, you know, churches and synagogues and mosques. So I don't think that the cold is going to stop us. You know, it's only made us stronger in the fact that it's forced other organizations to open their space to the organizers of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Let me ask you, if you have been impacted by some of the other groups that are also part, in terms of your political activism and your political persuasion or your perspective, have you been influenced by other groups? I know that the Occupy people tried to make a connection with the black community by marching up to Harlem to demonstrate against the practice of stop and frisk. Mm-hmm. And there are other groups and speakers. What has been the impact on you in terms of your personal political bent?
Well, I mean, I've been participating in those rallies as well. There's been a lot of rallies against police brutality, which, you know, I've been participating in as both an individual but also with my union, and engaged in, yeah, rallies against stop and frisk. And, you know, I'm also part of this action group, which is another working group, which plans these, like, national days of action. And there's, you know, plans for direct action and also more civil disobedience actions and things like that. So I don't necessarily feel like, you know, my political beliefs have changed. It's just, you know, been strengthened by all of, you know, I'm inspired. I'm tremendously inspired by what's going on there. So I can barely tear myself away from things that are happening down there. I'm just incredibly inspired and you know, hopeful for change to come in this country. I mean, I'm by day I'm working for the union, and until 11 o'clock at night or even later every day, I'm working on Occupy Wall Street stuff, mobilizing or organizing a part of meetings. So I think, yeah, my political bent is just growing, I guess, in capacity.
Well, the signal on our phone connection seems to be getting a little bit weak as Rose Bookbinder is on a train heading back to Western Mass from Occupy Wall Street and from her work in New York. So I'm going to let you go and enjoy the rest of the ride. And thank you, Rose Bookbinder of UAW, and I guess I could say of Occupy Wall Street. Thank you very much for being with Fred and Rose's show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Rose Bookbinder of the UAW, working with Occupy Wall Street. This has been another edition of the Bread and Roses Show. Stay tuned. We've got more coming up on valleyfreeradio.org, 103.3 FM. And be sure to tune in on Friday at 4 for the next edition of the Bread and Roses Show.
That the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing. Bread and roses.